Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. Okay, good morning. It's Sunday, the 1st of February, 2009, and drum roll, please. That makes this Solder Smoke 100, yes, the big centenary edition. A lot of guys have been writing in saying, what do I have planned for issue 100? Are we going to do a special greatest hit show, a big look back? And I thought about it. And I actually started doing it, but then I realized, no, that's not the way to go. This is a forward-looking show. There's no real need for a greatest hit show because all of our greatest hits are still available for download on the soldersmoke.com site. You can go back all the way back to issue number one. I did listen to a little bit of issue number one, and it was, as you guys can imagine, quite a nostalgic thing for me to hear the start of all this with Mike and I yakking away on Echolink, talking about technical projects. And you can go back and listen to those if you'd like, but I don't really think it would be good to chop up some of the old shows and put them here. So there'll be no greatest hits, but I will talk a bit about how this all got started, and because some people did write in and ask for the some information on the origins of Solder Smoke. It all really started, as I said, with conversations that Mike KL7R and I had on Echolink. We'd get on. The timing was really good because I was in London at the time, and I'm an early morning ham, and I get up real early. I get up at 5 o'clock every morning, and it's now it's only 6:30 here now. And Mike KL7R, he's more of a late night ham. So the timing was perfect. He'd be in the shack for his evening time at the same time that I'd be in my shack, pretty much on the other side of the world, morning time. So we would get together and start talking about projects. We discovered that we had a lot of technical things in common. I guess Mike was far more advanced than I was in many technical areas, but we were still hacking around, kind of around the same level. And so we would compare notes and talk about what we were working on. I knew that there was a certain level of kind of technical affinity there. When Mike told me that he had taken a Heathkit HW8 and had modified it for double sideband use, I'm a big fan of double sideband, and I had been working on double sideband rigs for 17 meters. So it seemed like there was a real connection there, and almost every project that Mike was working on, I was working on something similar. Sometimes, of course, we were working on things that were just completely different, and it was fun to hear what the other guy was working on. Anyway, we'd been meeting and talking on Echolink for some time, and then in late 2005, I came across a magazine. It's one of the great science and technology magazines of our time. It's New Scientist out of the UK. It's a weekly, really a wonderful magazine. I miss it. I don't get it here irregularly in Rome. But man, I that was one of the big benefits of being the science officer at the American Embassy in London, was I got a free subscription to the New Scientist. Anyway, in late 2005, there was an article in the New Scientist about this new thing called podcasting, and it was something like The Internet Killed the Radio Star, kind of a play on the old rock song of a similar title. And in the article, they described how amateur home-based disc jockeys were putting together these radio shows, and they talked about how people were using Skype to allow them to carry out around-the-world interviews and have one host in one part of the world and a co-host in the other part of the world and interview somebody in the third part of the world and slap the whole thing together and put the audio file out on the web and make it available as this thing called a podcast. Now, I got to admit, I was really behind the times, almost in a curmudgeon-like way in terms of what was going on with the MP3 players and audio. I remember riding around on the red double-decker buses in London and seeing all these people with these little white earphones in their ears and that seemed to be connected in many cases to their cell phones. And I remember thinking, I wonder what all these people are listening to. Of course, most of them are listening to music in MP3 files, but they could have been listening to podcasts, and I guess I was pretty out of touch with the whole technological revolution that made the podcasts possible. But anyway, I mentioned this all to Mike, and Mike, one of the areas in which he was far more advanced than I was in software and all things related to computers. Mike had actually been a pretty innovative software guy himself. I think at one point he told me that he had written and marketed a bit of software that was used back in the early days. Well, the next thing I know, I get this. I start getting emails from Mike with strange audio recordings in there. And what he had done is he had just gone ahead. He'd been intrigued by the idea, did a little bit of research, and put together our first podcast. He had, as we were speaking on Echolink, he hit the record button. I think it was unbeknownst to me. Anyway, he recorded the whole thing. Found some music, slapped together an intro, did some audio editing, and that conversation, and I guess it must have been late 2005, became Solder Smoke 1. And you can listen to it there. It's at the bottom of the screen at the soldersmoke.com page. And the rest is history. Off we went. We had a great time with it. We would meet once a week. I must say, I should tell you guys that we had Solder Smoke wasn't always the there was some discussion in the beginning about what we should call this thing, and I had another regular conversation on Solder Smoke with my friend VK7VK in Tasmania, Ross, and Ross and I used to get together regularly, and it would always be early in the morning. So I joked with Ross that we should call our conversations the Dawn Patrol. So Mike and I briefly discussed calling it Dawn Patrol, but then it wouldn't fit because it would have been it was dawn for me, but it was dusk for him. So Dawn Patrol didn't fit. And then at one point, Mike suggested Bipolar Junction. You know, for bipolar transistors. But, I had some disturbing psychological kind of connotations. So Bipolar Junction was put aside. And we came up with Solder Smoke. And Solder Smoke, the title really came from a line that I had read on one of the many messages from the, I think it was the Boat Anchors mailing list. And I think the guy who provided the quote, if I recall correctly, his name was Ian Abbott. And he put a line in one of his messages talking about how he had just finished building a receiver. And he said something to the effect that I then listened to the magical sounds that can only come from a receiver that you've built yourself in a cloud of solder smoke. So I said, wow, that line really kind of captured the spirit of what we do. So it stuck in my head, and I used it in the beginning of a QST article that I wrote about a receiver that I had homebrewed while back in Virginia. Anyway, Solder Smoke seemed to capture it, so obviously the title has been a big success, because I think it does convey that the spirit of the shack, the creative spirit, the home brewing, the building, but also the kind of the sense of fraternity. It's almost like we're all working in the same cloud of Solder Smoke, no matter where we are. Anyway, that's where it's all started. It's kind of sad to be talking about all this because we're now at the second anniversary of Mike's passing, and all I can say is that I really know he'd be delighted that we carried on here, and that his creation, because it was of course every bit as much his creation, probably more his creation than mine, continues. We always got a kick. He really got a kick out of the emails that came in and said that, talking about how people like the show, and that's one of the reasons we carried on beyond number one, and that's one of the reasons I continue with it today, because it's one of the most gratifying things in my day. I get far more satisfaction from this than from most of what I do at work. Certainly get more positive feedback here, and just about every day there's a message coming in from somebody in some distant part of the world saying that they like to listen to the show. So that's why we carry on. All right, that's it. That's the kind of the look back at the first 100. But now on to the second centenary. We always have a little bit of Rome travelogue, and we have a little bit this week. On Martin Luther King Day, we had Martin Luther King Day here off. We're lucky we get both American holidays and Italian holidays. And it's kind of nice because my kids don't get the American holidays because they get some of them, but most of them they don't because they're in essentially an Italian school on the Italian calendar. So when we have one of these American holidays come along, it's an opportunity for my wife and I to go out on our own and do some exploring in Rome. And we were up on the Palatine Hill, one of the most important of Rome's famed seven hills. And we were up there on Martin Luther King Day exploring the old home of Augustus, Caesar Augustus, Julius Caesar's adopted son, the guy who really became the first real emperor, the guy who introduced the concept of the emperor as a deity. So we were up there. It's a beautiful spot, great views of the rest of Rome. We can see our house from the Palatine Hill. it's nice to be up there and that really so historically significant place and look a little bit off and see our little apartment house there at the base of another hill, the Janiculum. We also, it was really interesting, we saw the what are reported to be and what are believed to be the shacks, appropriate use of the term, but the little huts, I guess, of Romulus and Remus, the legendary founders of Rome. These were the two brothers who were found on the banks of the Tiber River by the she-wolf, by the wolf, who took care of them and suckled them, and these are the two founders of Rome. What they have there is archaeological digs on settlements that go back to the founding of Rome, to the period of Romulus and Remus, and we're going back, I believe, to 750 BC, and really quite dramatic. Right next to Augustus's house, you can see you could see the foundations and how they set up these little huts and where people lived in Rome at 750 BC. Wonderful place. It's another reminder of what a great city this is, and so there's so much to offer, and we're really privileged to live here. That's this week's travelogue from Rome. Okay, now on to technical stuff. Since we last spoke, there's been some real significant technical progress and projects here, and I'm just dying to share this with you guys because there's been a lot of solder smoke emitted, a lot of solder melted here at I0/N2CQR. The first one, I got my old frequency counter fixed. You'll recall that the frequency counter it's the counter that I picked up at the Kempton Park rally outside London. I'm not sure exactly when, but I think it might have been the same day that I met up with Tony Fishpool at the rally, and we did a segment with Tony for Solder Smoke. Tony and I have kept in touch over the years, and he's helped me out with many projects and generously provided many publications and CDs from GQRP and Sprat. And he helped out again on this one because my old counter that had served me faithfully, it's Murphy's Law. Murphy is in the shack, let's face it. Murphy is lurking there amidst the solder smoke. I had the frequency counter, and I had it for a long time, but I didn't really need it. You know, you don't really need accurate frequency counter if you're, you know, using QRP gear and you know generally that you're in the band. It really doesn't matter what exactly your frequency is. I have my old Drake 2B with its dial parallax problem, so I just generally need to know that I'm sort of kind of somewhere in the band. I don't need to know out to four decimal places where I am. Well, when you get into QRSS, slow speed CW, you really do need to know because you have to get within a bandwidth of 100 hertz. That's the whole band. And just having a crystal for the right frequency is not gonna cut it. So just at the moment that I needed really high frequency accuracy, of course, that's the moment that the frequency counter goes toes up. And so it forced me to go through all kinds of gyrations, which you guys have heard about in terms of determining what my frequency is on the 30-meter band. All right, then it was kind of bugging me. You know, I had told you guys that I'm not really crazy about building or working on test gear. Mike was inclined to do this, but I said, you know, you need to draw the line. And I said, look, I like to build the rigs, but once I find myself building the test gear, well, the next thing you know, you'll be building test gear for the test gear, and then after that, you're in the vortex, and you're just going down into the black hole of home brewing from which there's no escape. But I made an exception here because this thing has been sitting there on the workbench, kind of glaring at me. You know, every time I look at it, it kind of seems to look at me and say, you appliance operator, you can't even fix this 1983 version of a frequency counter. It's been kind of taunting me because, as you know, I'm a very analog, non-digital kind of home brewer, and it's been saying to me that kind of I need to move forward, I need to get digital, I need to go back to JK flip-flops and logic gates and ands and ors and nans and all that. Okay, I decided to take a shot at troubleshooting. And I got out the manual. The manual for this thing's pretty good. It's actually a pretty good piece of gear to work on because there's plenty of room on the chassis. It's not all jammed into one chip, one mystery box. So it's quite spacious and there's a lot of discrete components between the logic chips. Hadn't really done any kind of logic or digital troubleshooting since about my last time I did it was probably 1979 when I was a teenage trainee at Fort Gordon, Georgia at the U.S. Army Signal School learning how to troubleshoot pulse code modulation, time division, multiplexing communications gear. That's another story. Sad story, by the way. Anyway, that experience kind of helped. And I just started poking around the counter got some clues as to how what was wrong, and it started narrowing it down. And I think I might have told you about the troubleshooting process. But anyway, I found, yeah, I did. I told you about that. But I found the chip. I found the bad chip. I knew exactly which gates were bad. Man, I was very proud of my troubleshooting skills. And I thought, well, the actual repair part's going to be easy. Because, you know, the hardest part of troubleshooting, the hardest part of fixing something is the troubleshooting. Which part's bad? Tony heard about this and very kindly put in the mail a replacement CMOS chip. The Italian mail system miraculously collaborated and cooperated, and the envelope was here. And, okay, so then I figured I'll just wait. When I get a few minutes, I'll pop the old chip out, pop the new one in, and the counter will be counting again. Well, it wasn't that easy. I discovered that getting one of these 8-pin dual in-line chips off the circuit board, off a double-sided circuit board, is not as easy as it may seem. Because, you know, okay, you go to the one side and you melt the solder and you use the solder sucker and you get most of it out, but then there's solder on the other side. You flip the thing over and you repeat the procedure and you go back and forth and back and forth. It's hard to get these things off the board, off the double-sided board. And I struggled and struggled, and finally I got really frustrated with the whole thing, and I just clipped off all the leads, and then I just started going at it with the solder smoke with the solder sucker, and it was a mess. I mean, I started lifting pads off the board. I started lifting whole traces off the board. It was a nightmare, and well, it wasn't quite a nightmare yet. Nightmare status came later, and I'll tell you about it. I finally. Man, it's like pulling a kind of a molar. This was the molar of electronic components, and I was trying to pull this nasty tooth out. And it was as if all the everything was just awful. And I got it out, and I surveyed the damage, and I tried to figure out how I was going to replace the lifted pads and the lifted leads. And you know, I realized putting the new one in there wasn't going to be a lot of fun either. Now, I have an excuse for what happened. And the excuse is like many of you who were born in or around the International Geophysical Year, I now require reading glasses, and I call them soldering glasses. And also, as I'm sure happens with many of you, I lose them a lot. I must have a dozen of these things. They're floating around the house, but some strange law of physics usually makes it so that when I need one in the shack, it's not here. It's usually someplace else. The kids are playing with it. I don't know. Billy's starting to light fires with the thing, with the sun. I don't know what's going on, but they're not here. And this time, they were not here, and I looked around. I couldn't find them. I didn't want to wake the family up. I was in early morning radio mode. And I didn't want to start rummaging around other parts of the house to wake everybody up. So I figured, I can see what I'm doing here. Yeah, no, I couldn't. I put the chip back in, and I soldered all 16 leads in, both sides. 32 soldering connections were made, expertly, using the soldering skills that I had picked up at Fort Gordon, Georgia. And all the soldering connections look good. I flipped this thing over. I fired it up. And, man, the numbers that were coming out of this thing, they weren't even really numbers. The seven-digit displays were just kind of, they're kind of gurgling and burping. And there were decimal points all over the place. It was a real mess. The thing was worse than before. At least before, it worked in one particular setting of the gates, the gate time and the input, it worked. Now it didn't work at all. And, well, I kind of let it be for a few days, which is a good thing. This is a sign. This is something that you learn after many years of working with this stuff. The new guys don't do this. The new guys will just get so frustrated that they'll just drive on and try to kind of power through the problem. You got to get over that. You got to put those instincts aside, and you got to say, "Look, I'll fix this thing another day, push it off to the side of the bench, and go back a few days later. And that's what I did. And I started looking at it. And you have other instincts, too, when you're trying to fix something. One of your instincts is, after a while, you realize sometimes it helps just put your finger on the device to see if it's getting hot. Man, this chip was getting hot. Hey, this was not an IRF 510 or a 6146. This thing's not supposed to get hot. It's supposed to be all cool, ones and zeros, digital logic, you know, almost no heat. But this thing was getting as hot as a, almost as hot as a 6146. So I obviously something was wrong. Now, by this point, I had found my my reading glasses, and I had them sitting there on the end of my nose, and I flipped it over, and that's when I made the horrible discovery. I had put this chip in upside down. You know, they all have the little U that's supposed to tell you where the top of the chip is. Well, every other chip, and it seemed like there were dozens of them in this thing, every other chip on the board had the U kind of smiling nicely up on the top where it's supposed to be. However, the one that I put in, it was an upside down. It was frowning, almost like it was frowning. It was like one of those little happy, you know, happy face symbols, but with the frown sign. So all the other chips are smiling nicely, and the one that I put in there upside down has given me the frown, the unhappy face. Man. Oh. Okay, so now I got to do the chipectomy again. I got to pull this thing out. I got to go through, unsolder. And now, but now I'm getting mad. So now I figured I already lifted half the pads. I might as well lift the other half. And I'm yanking and pulling and yanking and pulling. But now I got a problem, too, because this is the only chip I have, so I got to be gentle. I can't just go through there and clip all the leads off because I got to try to use it again. And it's really scary. Not scary, but frustrating, because I'm thinking, between all of my soldering, and I put a lot of heat on some of these leads, and then running it upside down for a significant amount of time, enough time to get it hot. This is a CMOS device. These things are sensitive. I have almost certainly burned this chip out, and I'm almost certainly going to break one of these little leads when I do this extraction. So this thing, I know all this work is probably going to be for nothing, but I got to give it a shot. I got to try to use Tony's chip in there to see if I can get this thing to work. Well, I get it out. I get the whole thing out, and I manage not to have broken one of the leads. Some of them are looking kind of shaky, but they're all still electrically connected to the chip. I clean out all the little holes, and I come up with a plan to replace the broken leads and the broken pads and the lifted pads. I actually use some little fine insulated wire I have, and I use some crazy glue to basically lay down bridges over the broken bits and the leads and everything else. And I think I've got all of the pins on the chip going where they're going. I make one final check to make sure that I'm not doing it upside down again. You could make sure I check that one really good. And then I went ahead and proceeded to solder in all, you know, 32 of the connections, 16 on each side of the board. Okay, the moment of truth. Turn the thing on and it passes the smoke test. No smoke was released. And I looked at the counter and I knew instantly, man, this thing was working. This thing was working beautifully. It was working in all settings. It was counting accurately. It was really good. I felt like Dr. House. You know this TV show? This TV show from the States about the kind of wacky doctor who is the genius medical troubleshooter. He makes mistakes sometimes. He screws up himself sometimes. But then he always manages to pull it out. And we've been watching it here. And somehow the kids, my wife and I, got interested in this show. Anyway, I felt like the Dr. House of digital frequency counters. That thing is fixed. Sometimes I'm so proud of it. Sometimes I just leave it on so that it's blinking. And I put it in the settings so that all the digits will be blinking. Sometimes I turn on a frequency generator so it'll just sit there accurately displaying 3579 kilohertz, 3579.2340. Get real accurate on us. The joy of fixing and troubleshooting. By the way, the guys thanked me for for I got a couple of emails from guys who thanked me for putting the chip in upside down because they had done something similar on a smaller scale. One guy, N1JER, said that he had soldered in a transistor backwards. Huh, that's not even really a mistake compared to what I did. anyway, these are the things that happened. The moral of the story is, you should buy lots of extra reading glasses and keep at least one of them permanently fixed to the workbench. All right, that's the frequency counter story. It was a lot of fun, not really, but very satisfying in the end. Then I used it. The other thing is, I used it, and I wanted to. Now I have an additional way, other than the Da Vinci Code frequency standard. I have an additional way of measuring and making sure that I'm in the QRSS band. My QRSS manned experimental propagation transmitting beacon has been cooking away quite nicely at 101.40.050 hertz, and I use the grabber of Johann ON5EX. He always shows me right around that frequency, around 050 in the QRSS band, and I measured my frequency then with the counter. The counter has me at 070. So I'm thinking that Johann, his grabber is more accurate than my counter, but in any case, the counter is probably only about 20 hertz high. And that's not bad for a piece of kind of junky gear found underneath the table at the Kempton Park rally. So, and now I have another way of checking my my frequency. And thanks again to Tony Fishpool for sending along that chip. Thanks a lot, Tony. You really saved the day. All right. Now, this brings us in a roundabout way. Well, this will lead in a roundabout way to the next big technical project. I told you guys that I've been into radio history lately. I'm reading Empire of the Air. I'm reading it very slowly because I only read it for a few minutes each day. But I read it on the bus on the way into work. Then I'll read a little bit in the evening, but it's a nice read. It's very well written. Again, it's great history, great bio, but I must say, it really is technically quite weak. And a number of guys have written in and said, no, well, maybe it isn't technically weak. Maybe he was just passing along the weak technical explanations of Lee DeForest, because as we know, DeForest had a really, really shaky or almost non-existent understanding of what was happening inside the triode tube that he had created. No, it's not that. It really is technically weak. I'm certain that the problem is that the author, who's a great writer and a great historian and biographer, just wasn't. He just doesn't have the knack, and so that a lot of the technical stuff, he just gets it completely wrong. I'll just give you one quick example here. I was looking at it last night, and he was describing the first EME tests that were done, and it was on January 10th, 1946, at a U.S. Army Signal Corps laboratory at Fort Evans on the coast of New Jersey. They were using radar to bounce signals off the moon, and they were using some equipment. They were using FM technology that had been pioneered by Howard Armstrong. But what the author says here, they talk about how they sent the radar signal out and then managed to detect it in its bounce back from the moon. And this is what the author writes. He says, However, let me try a third time. I'm sorry. However feeble the echo was that January morning, it had enormous consequences for the future of humanity. Armstrong's radar system had proved for the first time that FM waves, unlike AM, could penetrate the ionosphere, that band of ionized atmosphere gases, of ionized atmospheric gases encircling the Earth. Well, you know, that's not it, of course. It's not the modulation that gets you through, it's the frequency. But all kinds of, I shouldn't say all kinds, there's probably three or four times in the book where you get a clunker, a technical clunker like that. And it just makes you realize that Tom Lewis, the author, who's a wonderful author, just didn't have the knack. But it's kind of sad, too, because Harper and Collins, the publisher, if they had had at least one knack victim, one technically competent person read through it, they could have easily made the necessary corrections to make it also a technically accurate book, but they didn't. So this thing was, I think, clearly the product of the English majors. They should have had a knack consultant, or at least one knack qualified editor to go through it. Anyway, I still love the book, and one of the things that Tom Lewis really gets right and conveys is a sense of the radio art, and they use that phrase. You hear the Armstrong and others, a lot of the other technical people in the book, frequently making references to their desire to advance the radio art, and this sense of radio being kind of a collection of skills and techniques and a bit of a bit of black magic, collectively known as the radio art, is in there, and that's great. And the biography is really good. As you go through the book, you come to like Armstrong more and feel sorry for him, because he's almost like kind of an innocent caught up in these business and legal struggles when he wanted to just focus on the technology. You don't, you know, Lee DeForest comes across as really creepy almost from the beginning. Sarnoff starts out, being presented in a very favorable light, but as time goes by, he starts appearing to be more and more of a darker kind of negative personality in the book. So anyway, Armstrong's the hero. Armstrong's clearly one of us. Armstrong, you know, there's frequent references to Armstrong's ham radio roots and friends that he made in ham radio, and they and their collaboration with him. And that brings us to, I found a really interesting reference here related to this podcast. And I put the book down and just paused when I read this. It was kind of an interesting moment. In the book, they're talking about it's beyond the period when Armstrong invented first the regen and then the superhet. This is much later, and he's working on trying to promote. Well, he developed FM, and Armstrong heroically developed FM. In spite all of the many scientists and mathematicians who clearly, who very, very stridently said that FM was impossible. They were trying to take care of the static problem, and Armstrong worked for years, really, really hard, to come up with a system that would allow high fidelity radio transmissions that would take care of the static problem. And almost all of the learned physicists and mathematicians of the day just maintained this could not be done. And they came up with elaborate mathematical proofs showing that FM would not work. It could not work. It could not take care of the static problem. It was suggested that the static problem that plagued AM transmissions was just kind of a hardwired into the universe, and that most of the static was caused by electrons moving around inside the circuitry and all this. Well, Armstrong perhaps because of his distrust of kind of mathematics-based radio, he persisted. Actually, the mathematical proofs showing that FM wouldn't work probably benefited him because it caused other people to abandon FM. But he persisted, and he came up, and of course he developed FM, and of course it does take care of the static problem, and it takes care of the interference problem. He set up a demonstration to try to prove to people that this could work. And it says here, I'll read you a bit from this here. It's on page 266, and you'll see the relevance to the show. And when we get to this point, as he stood on the stage before the audience, Armstrong understood how important the lecture would be for him. After reminding his listeners of Carson's mathematical proofs and quoting some of the mathematician's sweeping statements, he described, without a single mathematical formula, how his system solved the problem of static and noise. Pictures of the transmitters and receivers at the Empire State and at Haddonfield appeared on a screen. Armstrong methodically described each one, a sound film on which he had recorded both FM and a standard broadcast as they were received in Haddonfield during a thunderstorm, proved FM's resistance to interference. Then, in a calculated, laconic tone, he said quietly, "Now, suppose we have a little demonstration." George Burghardt, waiting in the wings, parted a curtain to reveal what appeared to be an ordinary receiver. The audience first heard the typical chatter associated with a radio between stations. But when Armstrong tuned it to Runyon's station, the speaker was profoundly quiet. For the first time, startled listeners were hearing a clear broadcast of silence. No less startling, a few seconds later, was Randy Runyon's voice, as he said with absolute clarity, "This is amateur station WQAG at Yonkers, New York, operating on frequency modulation at 2.5 meters. Armstrong's little demonstration resembled the one Reginald Aubrey Fessenden gave on Christmas Eve 1906. But instead of surprising his listeners by transmitting voices and music as Fessenden had done, Armstrong astonished them by transmitting sounds with a clarity and fidelity never heard before. More surprising and unexpected sounds were to come. Runyon pouring a glass of water, playing a short piano piece, crumpling a piece of paper and then tearing it. The reverberations of a small oriental gong being tapped lightly." There you go, guys. The gong. I knew it had some sort of historical precedent. There we go. A small oriental gong being tapped lightly played a critical role in Howard Armstrong's demonstration of FM way back in, looks like, about 1936. All right. The gong. Now we know. The radio gods had kind of told us to use a gong. We've been using it all this time, and now we know that there's historical precedent. Thank you. Thanks, Tom Lewis, and thank you, Howard Armstrong. All right. You know, Empire of the Air got me thinking about feedback, and this is around the same time. You know, we've been talking about feedback and how it works and everything, and although Empire of the Air didn't go into the technical details, thank God, because God knows what they would have come up with. But I was thinking about two feedback questions. One, the issue of beta independence. How does that work? Why is it that feedback makes circuits kind of independence of the amplification or beta variations between individual devices? And the second question was distortion reduction. Why it is that negative feedback causes a reduction in distortion, And these are two questions that had me kind of scratching my head. Many guys wrote in and provided some help and advice, and I thank everybody for that. But I tell you, where I got the real answers for me, and you know, a lot of times you have to look at different books, and different people have different ways of understanding things, and some books are helpful for some folks and not for others. I have a pretty good library here with me in Rome, a technical library, and I found a little technical manual from the War Department from the summer of 1941, just before Pearl Harbor. And it gives, for me, the perfect way of describing how negative feedback helps take care of the beta independence problem, and also how it helps with distortion reduction. The explanations that the books provides are kind of a mixture of the mathematical and the intuitive. I've taken kind of my versions of both of these explanations and put them up on the blog at soldersmoke.blogspot.com. So if you want to take a look there. I've come up with one diagram from the manual and then one really crude diagram that I drew up to handle the distortion problem. But I think I've got it. I think I understand both aspects of negative feedback. I had earlier come to understand why and how feedback allowed you to control the gain and the not the gain, but the input impedance of an amplifier stage, and that of course is real useful. But it was kind of bothering me that I didn't have a good understanding of the beta independence part or the distortion part. So anyway, thanks to the War Department's 1941 manual for helping me figure that out. Hey, in the course of all this, in the course of all talking about radio history, I was trying to figure out, here's the thing, maybe somebody out here there can answer this question. I grew up, part of my time growing up, was up in Rockland County, New York, about 25 miles north of New York City, beautiful area, and my dad got us a house out there, and it was right on a lake called Lake DeForest, a reservoir. We weren't supposed to swim in it, but we did, of course. Sorry for anybody downstream, but there it is. We did. Anyway, it was called Lake DeForest, and it's an artificial lake. It was built probably Great Depression era or later. They just blocked the western spur of the Hackensack River, and boom, next thing you know, you got a lake about 5 miles long, about a mile wide, beautiful lake. And it's called Lake DeForest. And I just wonder, was it named for Lee? I hope not, but I'd like to know. If anybody knows about that, please shoot me an email. And in the course of researching this question, strangely, the internet did not provide the answer. I did a lot of searching, a lot of references to Lake DeForest, but no real explanation of where the name came from. The timing would be about right. He was in the area, and he was sufficiently egomaniacal to push for the lake to be named for him. But I discovered another radio pioneer, and this guy operated right in the little suburban town that I grew up with. His name is A. Frederick Collins, and he was a very early pioneer of radio telephone, of voice, of phone. And he operated right there from Congers, New York. He had a summer house up there, an estate, I guess a place he called the Antlers, in Congers, New York. Not a lot of great significance has happened in Congers, New York over the years, but I grew up there, and I was a radio guy there and a radio kid, and I never knew that one of the radio pioneers was there. His name is A. Frederick Collins, and A is for Archie. What a great name. Archie Frederick Collins, and a pioneer in radio telephone. I don't think he's any connection to the Collins of Collins radio fame much later. I don't think there's any connection there, but I have a picture of A. Frederick Collins and a description of his activities and some links up on the Blogspot page, so check it out. I think you guys would like it. All right, this brings us to the next technical project. All this talk about regens, all this reading of radio history, all this trying to figure out why degenerative feedback helps caused me. It was all just kind of brewing. Sometimes this thing happens. You know, a project, you don't know that there's a project on the horizon for you. You don't know that you're going to build something. But these forces are kind of pushing you in the right direction. And then all of a sudden, boom, something will happen. That'll be it. Okay, decided. This is what I have to build next. The message came to me in the form of Sprat 137, Winter 2008-2009 edition. It arrived, thanks to Tony Fishpool and the guys from GQRP. And the theme of this year's, or of this particular edition, is minimalist radio. Four minimalist radio transmitters, transceivers are in there, including the Bell Ringer, a wonderful rig by AA1TJ, Michael, the hero of the Hobbit Hole, the poet laureate of ham radio. His Bell Ringer is in there. There's also on the cover the Flea from Catalonia that we've been talking about. We've had that on the blog, a wonderful rig. But the one that really caught my attention was the first one. You open it up on page 3, an ultra-simple 80-meter CW transceiver, and the FET using just 14 parts by Roger, G3XBM. Roger's got this rig here, and I remembered it. Roger points out that the basis for this thing was a simple 40-meter CW transmitter done by Glenn, W2UW, that appeared several years ago in Sprat magazine. It appeared in Sprat 108, which came out in autumn of 2001. And I remember seeing this thing, and it's been in the back of my mind all these years. This is the rig where he builds the entire rig, both receiver and transmitter, with one MPF 102 FET. One little active device, and he mounts it on a four-pole double-throw switch. And then if you throw the switch in one direction, all the connectors hook up and make it a regen receiver. And if you throw the switch in the other direction, it hooks up to a different set of components and becomes a very low-power CW transmitter. It is amazing. The parts count, the total part count for a transceiver, total parts in W2UW's original rig was 15 parts. Roger builds his with 14. And I said, man, I just got to build this thing. And I built one. I've got on the blog, if you want to take a look, those of you who are in front of the computer right now, you can go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. And if you scroll down a bit, you'll see the original schematic from Glenn, W2UW. And then further up, you'll see a picture of my version. I didn't have a four-pole double-throw switch, but I did have a four-pole double-throw relay. And so I built mine. I had my MPF 102 FET up on top of the relay. The relay is mounted vertically on a bit of copper-clad board. The MPF 102 sits majestically, almost tube-like. You know how the tube sits there in a rig? That I always like the fact that the tubes would be kind of standing up proudly there, kind of doing their thing. Well, the MPF 102 in mine is sitting up proudly up on top of the big four-pole double-throw relay, and the associated circuitry is around it. I have not built the transmitter yet. I built the receiver. You know, I built regen receivers before, and I must say that they are not for the faint of heart. They require a lot of kind of fidgeting around with and tweaking and poking, and you got to get them working right, and then they're really kind of sensitive, and if you move something, it... Anyway, this is, what do you expect for a receiver with probably about 10 components in it and just one active device? But I got this thing working, and I'm listening to 80-meter CW on it, and again, it's one of those things where I just like to come into the shack and just listen to it. I'm using some Hi-Z headphones. I might try to find some headphones that are a little bit more sensitive and make it easier. I might go down to the basement and see if I can dig some of those up. Roger sent me a real nice posting to the Blogspot page. He posted a comment. He's been in contact with Glenn, W2UW. Glenn's in his 80s now, still active. And he reports that with this little rig, he had more than 450 QSOs. Glenn's rig was on 40 meters. But using this thing, he made 450 QSOs. The transmitter puts out about 18 milliwatts, just one FET. And, man, this is real, real minimalist radio. Mark, K6HX, who runs the really wonderful blog called the Brainwagon blog, really great stuff. Very creative guy. I really like the blog. Thanks, Mark. But Mark came in with a comment and Roger saw the comment and said, "Man, that made my day." Mark said that these kind of radios, especially the FET Glenn called his the ET1, the experimental transceiver one, because of one device. And I'm noting here that it also appeared in 73 magazine. Mark K6HX said this is like, and get ready for this because it's good, this is haiku from solder. Man, we have a surprising amount of poetry in this show. For technical guys, I must say a really surprising amount of poetry. And I know that AA1TJ is sitting up and taking notice of that comment. All right. So anyway, I'm going to build the transmitter this week. I don't know if I'm going to be able to make any contacts from this location with my compromise antenna, but I want to get it done. And who knows? I might be able to report a QSO. All right. There you go. Thanks for all the comments that people posted. And please take a look at that on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. All right, guys. Now for a bit of, I guess, what we could call nacatalism. Sort of like capitalism, but for the knack. Over the years, we've been slowly but surely introducing different kinds of commercial endeavors to the solder smoke community. My goal is to have other people send us money without actually having to do anything ourselves. This is a nice idea, and it sort of works. The ads that are placed there, the Google ads, the Amazon.com ads, it's great. It's a great way of supporting the show and buying the bits of software and hardware that I need to keep this thing going without actually getting any money from anybody. Well, this is sort of a variation on that. A while back, somebody sent me an email, and I got to dig up and find out who it was. Who was the genius that thought of this? Because it is a great idea. He said, look, why don't we have T-shirts? Why don't we have cups, bumper stickers, beer steins with solder smoke sentiments on them? It's relatively easy to do that these days through the facilities provided by a company called Cafe Press. And, gentlemen, I'm announcing now the opening, the official opening.
Bang the gong. Hold on.
The official opening of the Solder Smoke store. It's online. It provides T-shirts, sweatshirts, hats, mugs, beer steins, and bumper stickers. Maybe we'll add more stuff in the future. But the idea is that I sit around here in the shack sometimes and I think of things about, I think, what would guys like on bumper stickers? What would guys like on T-shirts? What would guys like on hats? We're going to introduce also, by the way, a kind of a solder smoke tote bag for use in the upcoming Hamfest season. But let me tell you about some of the stuff that's available at the store, because I think that you'll like this. These are some of the sentiments that appear T-shirts, bumper stickers, on T-shirts, bumper stickers, hats. My rig was homebrewed in a cloud of solder smoke. I'd rather be in my shack drinking coffee and listening to solder smoke. How about a nice T-shirt that boldly says to the world, solder smoke makes you want to build radios. Got to have one of those. This is a favorite. This is one that's been that actually people have been out buying, and this one has been selling quite well, I must say. A bumper sticker. How about this for a bumper sticker? My other car was homebrewed from junk box parts. Solder smoke. Now here's one for the, I guess for the folks out in the in kind of the firearms areas of the country. It's kind of NRA oriented. It says, I'll give up my soldering iron when they pull it from my cold, dead fingers. That would go good with a like New Hampshire license plate, you know, live free or die. There you go. You got to get one of those. All right, now here, this one, we're getting a little bit more jocular here. This one, when somebody sees this on your car, only a very small audience will know what you're talking about. QRSS operators do it very slowly. Get it? Yuck, yuck, yuck. And this one's my favorite. I want to get one of these myself. I don't get any freebies here, so I'm going to order like everybody else. Solder smoke. And then this could go up on the it's available right now on a t-shirt and on a bumper sticker. But I think it captures the spirit of the show. Solder smoke. International Brotherhood of Electronic Wizards. The IBEW with a twist, guys. That's who we are, the International Brotherhood of Electronic Wizards. Anyway, t-shirts, coffee mugs, bumper stickers, hats with all of these fine sentiments and many more are available at the Solder Smoke store. Now, to get to the Solder Smoke store, just go to the Blogspot page, soldersmoke.blogspot.com, and you'll see up in the left a little hat, one of our products. Click on the hat. It'll take you to the store. Or there's a link there. You can click on the link. It's easy to find. And then we have, I guess, the 25 or so products that are available there. You order them from the Cafe Press people. It's available. You can pay in U.S. dollars and U.K. pounds. I didn't see euros up there, but that might be coming. But it's available for payment in both dollars and pounds. And the good folks at Cafe Press then will take it from there and send you the products. We'll be introducing more. If anybody has any ideas, any bumper stickers they'd like to see, any things they'd like to see on t-shirts, send it my way, and we'll get it into the inventory. It's actually quite a fun way to do this, and I think people will get a kick out of these products. I also hope that it helps foster the sense of community that's been developing here since we started back in late 2005. All right, now. Man, this is a long one. We're going to go overtime here. That's okay. We've got a lot of good mail. And that brings us to...
Time for...
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
I love
it. Indeed.
Indeed, Solder Smoke Mailbag. Sean, N3ZHP, reports that he has the knack. He's new to radio, and he definitely has the knack because he tells us that his goal is to build every piece of gear in his shack. Fine business, Sean. Stick with it. That's an admirable sentiment. That's the way to go. Do it completely homebrew from the beginning. Okay, we got a nice message from Steve Snort Rosin Smith, WB6TNL. And he provides some interesting historical information here. You know, we have... two Steves. One is Melt Solder, and one is with Steve Webb. And Steve Weber is a Melt Solder, and Steve Smith is Snort Rosin. I was thinking we're almost getting like into kind of mafia nicknames here. You know, Tony the Fish Lonzano or something like that. Now we have Steve Snort Rosin Smith and Steve Melt Solder Weber. Anyway, Steve Smith points out that his use of the Snort Rosin nickname is kind of a West Coast response to Steve Weber's Back East Melt Solder moniker. Steve Smith says that this kind of harkens back to his, quote, hippy-dippy days during the 1960s. Steve comments on the video about surface mount soldering, and he hints, and I'm just passing it along here, guys. I don't want to start a big flame war or anything, but he hints that that air embossing tools, you know, as opposed to soldering irons and soldering guns, that air embossing tools really are for girls. Maybe we should leave that alone. Maybe I should edit that one out. We'll see. He loves Drake 2Bs. He loves radios that don't come with menus. We're with you there, Steve, and thanks for the historical information on snorting rosin. Scott AC0GG talking about the audio problems for solder smoke. He suggests a new microphone with an equalizer. Yes, good. I'm with you, and if And if more people buy through the Amazon.com link, maybe we can save up and buy one. But thanks for that, Scott. And he provides a good link to Forrest Mims, another hero of the Solder Smoke community. Got a nice email from Jim, AL7RV. I think I told you that in the last episode that he was laughing so hard that when I was talking about design build, that his wife thought he was having some sort of a fit. Fortunately, he was not. He says he's thinking of going, putting out a QRSS signal from his recreational vehicle. Jim travels around in an RV, and he was suggesting putting a location GPRS, GPS information in his QRSS transmission. I wrote back and said, no, don't do it. Make the QRSS guys triangulate you. See if this could be a tech challenge. Maybe AL7RV will be QRSS mobile from different locations, and we'll maybe leave it to the intrepid QRSS MEPT community to try to pinpoint or at least generally locate from where he's the location from which he's transmitting. Get the Knights to triangulate. All right, there we go. That's my challenge of the week. Got a nice email from George K8VU. And George is helping me out with Solder Smoke, the book, a book project that we hope to launch pretty soon. But he sends in a real nice email this time about a kid who was actually busted by the FCC for an illegal transmitter. I've got that up on the Blogspot page. I think you guys would like it. Check it out, soldersmoke.blogspot.com. I really identified with this because as a teenage ham, I lived in fear that that men in dark suits from the FCC would come knocking at my parents' door one day and report something was technically amiss with my Heathkit DX40 transmitter. Craig, KC2LFI, continues to take time out from his medical duties to help diagnose my audio problems here. And he sent me more information on notch filters that we could use to get rid of the sibilant S problem that we have here at Solder Smoke. Thanks, Craig, for the help, and I'm going to dig into that problem and see if we can make some further progress. Thanks for thanks for all the prescriptions there, old man. David, KB1BED, he saw a Drake 2B on eBay, and he sent me the link. This Drake 2B had a buy it now price of, brace yourselves, $899 US. Wow. Holy cow. Now, David blames this on me. He blames it on Solder Smoke. He says all this discussion of Drake 2Bs on Solder Smoke has driven up the market price of Drake 2Bs. You know, first we were being held responsible for the inflationary prices on solid state design for the radio amateur. And I noticed a big discussion of this on QRPL. All I can say, guys, it's not my fault. I talk about it a few times. If the market responds, we live in a free market economy. I guess this is another example of nacatalism at work. But David reports that Drake there's a spike in Drake 2Bs. So in these days of crashing stock markets, perhaps it is a good time to take all your money out of the market and invest in solid state design for the radio amateur and Drake 2Bs from Miamisburg, Ohio. That is this week's Solder Smoke investment advice. Okay. all right. Steve, G0FUW, spotted a strange ad in Radcom in which a radio amateur was looking for parts that were apparently to be used in some sort of thermonuclear device. Let's hope that this QRP project, or QRO project, I guess it is, does not come to fruition. Nobody send this guy any parts, please. Steve, just kidding. Steve also reports that the second bath build-a-thon was a big success, and get this, I love to hear it. 10, count them, 10 double sideband rigs were born in a cloud of aromatic 6040 solder smoke. A cloud of 6040 aromatic solder smoke gave birth to 10 double sideband rigs somewhere in England. Fine business, Steve. Thanks for all your good work on that, and appreciate the email. Brian, NF0G, is home brewing at 20 below zero in Minnesota. And he points out that for my sidewalk astronomy activities here in Trastevere, Rome, the Comet Lulin is coming into view and should be a good binocular or telescope object soon. So maybe we'll take the telescope out and show the Trastevereini, the Comet Lulin. Tony, G4 LLW is using a frequency standard kit from G4 CFY. He's got it phase locked to a BBC transmitter on 198 kilohertz, and is using this for getting ready for QRSS operation to get in the band. He passed along some IC integrated circuit chip extraction techniques. The one that I discovered on my own the hard way, and provides some information on ARC based phone transmitters. That's the kind that A. Frederick Collins was using back in Congers, New York, back in 1908. I got a really, really cool email. You know, we get emails from guys who listen to Solder Smoke in all kinds of different places, but this one was probably the most exotic location. At least, well, you'll understand what I'm saying. Kevin, Alpha Alpha 7, Yankee, Quebec, listened to Solder Smoke 90 in Yellowstone National Park. Now you may ask yourself, what's unusual about that? Lots of people go to Yellowstone. Some of them bring solder smoke. Well, Kevin's trip into Yellowstone was a bit unusual. Kevin was a smoke jumper, a fire jumper, one of these heroic guys who jumps out of the airplane in small teams and goes out to fight fires in remote locations way out there in the wilderness. So Kevin sent me this really, really cool message about the jump. He jumped into Yellowstone that day to fight a fire at a remote location. They took care of business and took care of the fire and had an hour or so to wait before getting extracted by a helicopter. So he describes the jump and then says that he had about an hour to wait, and he had his iPod in his rucksack. So as they were waiting for the helicopter with the forest still smoking a little bit, a lot of smoke rising up around him, he went to the iPod and realized that he still had episode number 90 on there. So he sat there with his rucksack and amidst the forest smoke, listened to Solder Smoke number 90. And I think in that was one of the episodes that I made a rare reference to my own experience with parachutes and parachute jumping. So he was surprised to find another knack victim with a parachute past. He said, we'll call it the Paranac. All right. But thanks for sending that along, Kevin. Kevin, that was Kevin's last smoke jump, by the way. I'm honored to have accompanied him on the last jump. He's moved on to other work, which is probably a good idea since he's now got a small child to take care of. I'm glad I'm no longer in a line of work that requires me to jump out of airplanes at 2 o'clock in the morning. it would offend my parental responsibilities. But anyway, there we go. And thanks for that message. What else? We got even more email. ZL2GDN Graham, working on lots of good projects. Interested in QRSS and DSB. Fine business, Graham. Thanks for the note from ZL Land. Stu, N6 TTO is joining the slow revolution. You know, you got slow cooking here in Italy, slow food. Now we've got slow radio. Stu, this weekend, has a QRSS beacon on for the first time. It's FSK signal on or about 10140060. Please give a listen for Stu. Looks like he's transmitting from Six Land out there on the West Coast. And give him a listen. Mark, K6HX, we mentioned him before, of the Brainwagon blog. He's now starting to homebrew, and he's hoping to work towards building a 100 milliwatt 30 meter transmitter. Mark says that he has not yet reached the design build phase, and he's still kind of at the hacking away phase. And I said, that's fine. We all go through these phases. He lost, get this, he lost his copy of Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur. And then when he saw all the chatter on QRPL about how valuable these things was, these books were, he became quite nervous and launched a frantic search around the house for his copy of SSDRA. He searched and searched, you know, and he finally found it. You know where it was? His wife had put it on the radio bookshelf. Man, found it. All right, glad you found the book, Mark, and I'm sure you're gonna put it to good use. Robin, AF1RE, got launched into a round of homebrewing mania when he heard BitX20s on the air. He started studying schematics, and the next thing you know, I think he's going to build one. That's what happens when you hear these kind of rigs on the air, Robin. Good luck with the project. Jerry, Echo India 8, Delta Radio Bravo, finally got the Drake 2B that he asked about. You'll recall he asked me whether he should buy a Drake 2B, and I said, yeah. He thanks G3VTT, who helped with the purchase, and passed his respects to G3ZWH, now a Silent Key, the man who took care of it, and also thanks to old man ZWH's XYL, who took care of it, and we're glad to hear that Drake 2B has found a good home. Finally, Ray, W0DHP, a frequent correspondent here to Solder Smoke, told a story about listening to Solder Smoke 97 while walking through London from Waterloo Station on his way to work. Just listen to this. Just at the moment that he was hearing our discussions of aromatic solder smoke, you know, that Snort Rosin out there on the left coast has been talking about the aroma value of various brands of solder smoke. Just as he heard this discussion, walking down the street in London, he sniffed and he could smell it. He could smell solder smoke at that particular moment. How spooky is that? He claims that it was from some work that people were doing right there nearby on the streets in London. But I think it may be something more mysterious than that. Cue the X-Files music at this point. Thanks for the mail, guys. Gosh, we're over time. This is one of the longest episodes of Solder Smoke. Thanks for joining me in that trip down memory lane. I hope you enjoyed the show. Have a great great couple weeks ahead. 7-3 from Rome.